We must acknowledge that diversity, equity, belonging is also about living with chronic illness. It is about disability, and disability is often invisible.
Welcome back to the Pajama Interviews, the podcast for every woman living with chronic illness. This week, I am so thrilled we're speaking with Salesforce executive Fati Katabloom, and we are talking about her long career as well as her experience of chronic illness. Stay tuned at the end for this week's exciting announcement, and now let's dive in. Fati, I'm so excited that we're going to talk.
I'm so excited to be here, and it's so nice to have a face-to-face conversation with you again. It's been too long.
Yeah. So the first thing I wanted to ask you was about your diagnosis and your process to diagnosis, if you're willing to share with us.
Yeah, sure. It's very distant for me because it was when I was about nine. So I have Hashimoto's, which is a thyroid disorder. It is autoimmune. And my mother, who also suffers from Hashimoto, diagnosed me when I was about 9 years old because she felt that my thyroid was enlarged. And I remember she took me to the pediatrician and they sort of poo-pooed her and you're being a hypochondriac, there's nothing wrong. And she insisted because she's my mom, and they tested me, and indeed I was lacking significant amounts of thyroid hormone. And so I've been on hormone replacements and hormone therapy for my thyroid since before puberty, really. So it feels very, very distant to me, the diagnosis itself.
Amazing.
And yeah.
It's just amazing about your mother and her, like, that's a big thing to insist as well. And I'm very fascinated by her being such a big advocate at the very beginning of your experience of chronic illness, like right at the very beginning, because most people don't have that level of advocacy at that beginning spot.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think my mom, frankly, is a better advocate for me than she's been for herself. It's easier to advocate for others, you know? I suffered migraines very young, and those were also genetic. My dad suffered migraine, and so she, I think, was very acutely aware of what was going on with my body, trying to help minimize my migraines, all of the things that you'd want to do as a mom. And so I think she was just really aware of all of the things that were going on. And so literally she felt that my thyroid was just swollen. And that was it. That was enough for her to insist.
Fascinating. And then, as you say, what happened next, Fati, from your whole experience then?
So Michelle, it's really funny because as long as I was living at home and my mom was responsible for my care, it didn't affect me. I mean, not to the extent that I think about it today, right? Because she handed me the pill every morning and she was responsible for the care. It wasn't until I hit my mid-teens when I sort of took on the responsibility myself, and concurrently began to experience my first bout of clinical depression. And those two things kind of going hand in hand, I think was the first time that I realized, oh, like, my body and my mind don't quite function the same way that other people that I go to school with. And that was a period wherein I'd say two things happened. The first is it was also my first backlash. It was my first sort of like, I don't want this crutch, right? Like, I want to be normal. I don't want to have to take this pill every day. And so I kind of wouldn't. There would be days and weeks when I wouldn't take my medication. And of course, that compounded the depression significantly. But also through puberty, the need for adjustments to thyroid medication and thyroid hormone changes. And so I had this like convergence of, I'm being a teenager and I want to be normal and I don't want to take these medications anymore, compounding with really deep clinical depression and made worse by the fact that I wasn't taking the medication and I was on the wrong doses of medication and nobody could get a good read of my thyroid levels because I would take, like, the week leading up to a thyroid test, I would double up my doses, go and get the blood work done, things would look okay. And that was it. I wouldn't take them for another 3 to 6 months.
Wow. And so this is beautiful in telling the raw truth. Like, we're right in the grid. And we all know, no matter how old we are, we all know the times we didn't take the medication. And I think that's such a normal response to being medicated and to having your body requiring for some more functionality than it would otherwise have medication. But it's also that the history of medicating women is not a great history either. And so it's complex. It's not just our side. It's also very cultural. So I'm curious then, Fadi, as you moved into, you know, young adulthood and started to move into work and study, what did that look like for you on the chronic illness journey?
Yeah. Throughout college, I continued to be very resistant to medication. And I look back now and I wonder what kind of damage I actually did to myself during that probably 4 or 5 year period of time when I was really, really non-compliant. My bigger problem as I went through college and entered the workforce, to be honest with you, was migraine. I had a very poor grasp of what my triggers were, what was causing it for me. And I knew only that I would almost inevitably have a migraine crash after a period of elevated energy and elevated work and elevated excitement and like the things that are really exciting when you're first working. You know, you're working on a project and it's really great and you've got all of the endorphins and the adrenaline running through, and then you deliver the project or you deliver the paper and boom. It probably took me 3 years to figure out that pattern particularly well. And it probably defined the first 5 or 6 years of my work life, coming out of school.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot. I mean, I had migraines severely too. I don't remember having them as much in my 20s. I definitely had them, but I remember the last 5 or 6 years of me working in a corporate job, I had them 3 times a week, and I would go home. I would make it to the end of the day. I would go home, get in the dark room, take whatever I could, crash, get up and eat after sleeping, maybe at 10:30, go back to sleep, wake up still with the tension. But by that stage, I had negotiated working part-time because I was working on other creative projects. And I just had this, if I make it through by Wednesday, I can just rest my body Thursday, Friday, and then I can do what I want. But I'm pretty sure you're talking about working full-time and under pressure as well. I'm wondering if you can just describe for us what work looked like for you at that time and sort of what the trajectory you wanted to be on as well. That sort of, I'm sure, is part of the story.
Yeah, it's a great question. I was a marketing coordinator at a catalog company. And so we released catalogs 4 times a year, 6 times a year. I can't quite remember. But I was responsible for like literally getting the final files and the final proofs out the door, like driving to the Federal Express office at 5 o'clock and being there and delivering this thing at the very last minute into their hands that would then go to a printing press the next day. And so like really high energy, really high pressure, high stakes. And I loved it. I loved it. Now, what's really interesting is I got to a point where I could navigate it and say, and my boss knew, after something is out the door, Fati's gone for 2 days because she's going to be doped up with heavy, intense medication trying to get through the next 18 hours. And mostly like once we figured it out, I was really fortunate to have a very caring boss and employer. And I consider them both mentors, and they navigated it with me. You know, they were open to that. How do we make this work for everyone? There have been other situations where it hasn't been so great. So after I kind of left that job, I was there for 5 or 6 years. I learned probably everything I could. That was in Southern California, and I moved to San Francisco, and this is sort of 1999. And I entered the agency world, like the creative agency world, which is a very different story and very demanding. When your client says jump, you say how high, right? And that's sort of like the environment of creative agencies, you know, for time immemorial. That was harder because my clients were my bosses effectively. And there's only so much air cover that the agency managers and the agency bosses can provide. Like if a customer has a need, if a client has a need, you've got to show up. And that was hard because I think like you, I found for me, there was no way to work through the day. My work was on computer screens. Like if I had Aura and it was starting and a migraine was starting, like at that point I was gauging whether or not I had enough time to get home. Like that's how bad it would be. So that really kind of carried through, I would say, my late 20s. I think it was 27 or 28 when they finally started to abate. And it was hard. Now, interestingly, at that same period of time, in that same sort of 5 or 6 year window, when I was at the agency, the thyroid also was flaring back up.
Yeah.
And if I'm being honest with myself, that's when I really started to take it seriously. That's when I started to notice my body failing me when I didn't take medication.
Yeah.
So early 20s.
So you start at 9. By the time you're actually 20 years now of living with chronic illness by this point. And what mm-hmm. I'm hearing you is that since it's almost accountability, it's the difference between responsibility and accountability. You're actually like, okay, I'm driving the ship. This isn't going to change. I need to work this out for myself. And I'm curious what that looked like once that kicked in for you. Like how were you treated, or how did you see the world, the working world now, once that accountability became the next step in your journey for you?
I mean, frankly, a big part of it is that I was able to show up better. My mind was sharper. I felt more creative. My body cooperated. I didn't have bouts of exhaustion so intense that I just didn't know how I was going to get out of bed. And it took, you know, being in my early 20s and feeling like an old woman sometimes, feeling like the fatigue I was experiencing at the age of 25, there's something wrong. And I remember, you know, and this predates like Dr. Google and WebMD and all of those things, right? Like the information wasn't so readily accessible to us then. And I remember finally making an appointment with an endocrinologist and her sitting me down and explaining why not treating my thyroid with the respect that it deserves would break my body, would eventually, and she couldn't have known. I mean, I don't know that we would get into this otherwise, but I've never wanted kids. But when you're 25, nobody believes that. There's no doctor in the world that actually will believe you if you say, I never want to have kids. And so, you know, this endocrinologist was very like, you're going to have fertility problems and you're going to have an increased risk of osteoporosis and you're going to have other autoimmune things and you're going to have a hard time losing weight and it's your metabolism is going to break. And when your metabolism breaks, that's forever. And she really kind of, yeah, forced me to respect this tiny little gland in my body that I had just thought of as this like annoyance in the past and now realized, hey, this thing is actually really calibrating a lot of the functions in your body and you really have to pay attention to it.
It's so interesting that we hear, like we all have experiences with clinicians, but she was the right one at the right time to communicate to you for you to hear it in a way that worked for you. And by this stage, like there's thyroid, there's migraine, and there's depression as well. So what I'm curious about, Fadi, is I'm sure as we know, your career moves on and I'd love to, you know, explore what that looks like. What I'm deeply curious about is, are you telling people if you haven't recognized it or the importance, what's your relationship with everybody else? And also, as I know, so many of us with chronic illness push harder, push further, you know, really work at the best possible level of capacity we have because we know there's a crash in the hood. So what did it look like to everybody else in relationship to you and work?
I was pretty open about migraine because you can't really hide it. And I think you just got to be open about that. I'm trying to think if I ever talked to anybody about the thyroid. And I don't think I ever brought it up. But I remember very distinctly a woman that I was friends with, I guess I would have been early 30s by now, was having all kinds of, you know, her hair was falling out and she's having like all kinds of problems. And I think that was probably the first time I said to somebody, have you had your thyroid tested? It's really underdiagnosed in women our age. And she subsequently went and got her thyroid tested and she did in fact have Hashimoto. And this is a woman who was also trying to conceive at the time and was having a really hard time conceiving. And like, it sort of changed the narrative for her so much that I became more open about talking about it. And it no longer felt like, I think that was also a period, if I'm thinking back, like we started to understand a little bit more about autoimmune disorders. We heard more about lupus. We heard more about Epstein-Barr. We heard in the US, certainly, you know, people getting Lyme disease and having to live with the consequences of that for years. And so I think it became more acceptable to talk about an autoimmune disorder, but mental health I did not talk about, not for years, not for years longer. And yeah, in the workplace, like you don't talk about depression and anxiety disorders, like not until fairly recently. And as you know, I am now an open book. I refuse to keep it hidden. I talk about it on my very public Twitter. I talk about it on LinkedIn. I think it's incredibly important to normalize this stuff and to destigmatize it. But I didn't get to that place until 3 years ago, 4 years ago.
And this is my curiosity, because I feel like, and we're right, I just have this, we're in the sensitivity of 3 or 4 years ago, you had also reached such an incredible point in your career as well. And I'm wondering if you could talk about what your career looked like at that point, and then what that space of having potentially the privilege of being respected and speaking as well, rather than building, what that looks like for you by that time.
Yeah, so I'll give you a tiny bit of background, which I think is important to contextualize this. So after I left the marketing world, I went to work for a company called Forrester Research, and I was writing about marketing ethics and privacy and data protection and, you know, digital identity in the context of, like, there's all of these giant companies kind of arbitraging our identities on the basis of, like, the things we click on and the things we look at and the, you know, the friends that we have online. And it became really clear to me that through my entire career and through my personal interests, the thing that really drives me and the thing that I'm always working on is rooted in identity. And you and I have sort of had this conversation before, because I'm a first generation immigrant who left the country of her birth under really awful circumstances. It was when the revolution happened in Iran, and there was a hostage crisis, and there was, like, all this stuff going on. And like, there was never any expectation that my family would stay in America. People thought the revolution will blow over, we'll all be able to go home. And so I have always been an in-between kid. I'm not quite American enough. I'm not quite Iranian enough. I'm first generation. I'm the eldest daughter, the eldest child. My relationship to my identity is really deep. And the way that I have had the privilege of, A, being white passing until you see my name, means that I've been able to curate my identity really well, both for family and for work and for school and in all contexts. Likewise, as a person who suffers mental illness, as a person who suffers chronic illness, I've been able to manage those identities. And so my interest lies in our relationship to our identities and our right to our identity. So 4 years ago, I had reached a fairly kind of the apex, in a sense, of writing research about this, writing and speaking to audiences about the importance of agency and autonomy in the digital world. Because it's not fair that because I do a Google search for anxiety disorders or side effects of a new medication that I'm on, that suddenly that becomes part of some digital identity and some digital breadcrumb trail that I'm leaving behind, right? Like, that doesn't feel just or fair. And so that's what I was working on. And I also had a mental health crisis. I had a very bad mental health crisis. I was in hospital. And when I came out, I decided I was done hiding. That as someone with, this is such a like weird thing to say, but as someone with an audience, as someone with the right to speak to people who listen, who respect the research that I've written and spoken about, like, I have a moral responsibility to not support the stigmatization of these things by not talking about it.
It's interesting because what you're also talking about when we talk about an audience for you is you're not talking about an Instagram audience or a social influencer audience. You're talking about actual credibility that you have built through things you have done. And I'm wondering if you could describe for us, like, what did your day look like in terms of, for nobody who's ever seen you or heard you, what does it mean to have an audience? Like, who are you talking to? Where are you talking? And who's in that audience party?
This is before I joined Salesforce last fall. When I was in my sort of public speaking, public writing world, on any given week, I might be publishing research about privacy or ethics or diversity, equity, and inclusion in marketing. I might be writing some blog posts. I might be syndicated in Forbes. A blog post I wrote might be syndicated in Forbes or in Harvard Business Review. I might be on the radio, or I might be talking to the New York Times about my research and what that looks like. And then I would be speaking on stages that could be, you know, 2,000 people, 3,000 people audiences. I could be sitting in a boardroom with the executives of a company who are worried about whether there's enough representation in their marketing, whether they are using customer data ethically, whether they're using their platforms to build trust with consumers and employees. And so it was a very varied set of kind of tasks or jobs and interactions that I had. But I started to use Twitter a lot more. And I don't have a huge Twitter following. I think I've got like 5,000 or 6,000 followers. It's not huge, but it is people who are interested in the stuff that I talk about. And so it became increasingly important. And I'll tell you the sort of moment and the event where I realized I need to be way more out there. It was right before the pandemic started. And I'd been asked to moderate a panel by a very large company called LiveRamp, a technology company. And I'd been asked to moderate a panel about the convergence, and this is some research that I'd written, the convergence of diversity, equity, and inclusion and privacy and privacy ethics and the importance of those things. And I was sitting there in this room, and it was a breakout session with some unbelievably brilliant people. If you've never followed either Aubrey Blanche, an incredible DEI person, or Belinda Smith, they're both incredible women. And I was moderating this panel with the two of them, the president of LiveRamp and another gentleman. And there were like 20 people in the breakout, and the conference and the event itself was probably 3,000, 2,000. And I was like, I'm not talking loud enough. Like, I'm not talking about this stuff outside of other contexts nearly enough. And so that became the sort of tipping point for me of, we must talk about these things in the corporate environment. We must acknowledge that diversity, equity, belonging isn't just about race or gender or ethnicity. It's also about neurodiversity. It is also about living with chronic illness. It is about disability, and disability is often invisible. And like, we have to include these things in the conversations that we're having about DEI.
Yeah. And this really links to something, the work that I'm fascinated and in as well, is now how do we take this conversation to expand so that chronic illness is in D&I? And one of the things about that is, firstly, when we look at the statistics of people living with chronic illness in America, it's 133 million people. And in Australia, it's 47% of Australians. But here's the trick A lot of this conversation about chronic illness is in the burden of disease conversation. And a lot of the mm-hmm. stats are actually in the burden of disease. Some mm-hmm. of the stats that private corporates like Deloitte or PwC, whoever's doing some of this work around the burden of disease, stats for government, are also talking then about 70% of these people are working part-time and full-time. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But what we don't have is the drill down in that data to the person who's actually trying to navigate the experience. So that information and that data is something my colleague and I are working on literally at the moment. We're drilling down into the data. And one of the reasons for that is that in the conversations I'm having with companies that take, for example, neurodiversity is getting some traction at the moment. It's starting to be seen as we have a lot of talent who isn't able to advance because they're not vocal enough or they're not seen to be in the right form. However, what we aren't having a conversation about is all of the women, including you, you know, in this whole career process, who have navigated chronic illness while working and what that actually looks like for their experience. Mm-hmm. Plus, because we don't talk about it, because there's not the data, you know, actually translated over to talent management and what that looks like, we don't have the right support. We don't have the right conversation. We don't have the inclusion. And what that means from our research is that managers, the person with the chronic illness is often telling their manager. They're not telling HR. They're telling their manager. That means that the manager and them are trying to work out how to navigate their corporate career under the radar with chronic illness.
Mm-hmm.
And what that looks like is almost where you started this conversation, Fadi. We know if Jennifer has chronic illness and she works on this thing that she only can work 5 hours or she's going to have a crash or she's hospitalized. So we're not going to count that sick leave. We're going to do that at the other end of the project and backdate it. Or the manager is struggling, who has such empathy but is struggling about how to actually get the work done. And nobody is having the conversation about what's the conversation to have with the person having chronic illness? What's the conversation the chronic illness person is having with the organization? How do we navigate this experience? How do we do that in a functional way? And how do we do that in an inclusive way? And that's the conversation that we are in the open moment for. And I'm so grateful as a woman living with chronic illness for all of the diversity, equality, and inclusion spaces that have been, you know, created and been addressed. And this one, it's now time because this, the problem with illness, when we use the words chronic illness, the problem is that if you have illness, you're supposed to get well. And so that conversation is all about getting you back to wellness. And chronic illness, you're not going to get well. So the support actually needs to be for the lifetime of your employee rather than a health and wellness intervention, because it's not in the domain of health and wellness, which is how we think of illness. It's actually exactly what you're talking about. It's identity. It's awareness, acceptance, and advancement. And that's the conversation I think we're in. And I'm so curious, Fadi, to hear your response in the time that we have to this conversation we're now in.
It's so important and it's so timely. And I think there's two things that as you were talking, I kind of wanted to touch on and pick up on. Aubrey Blanche, who, as I mentioned, is brilliant, has said to me, can I curse? Can I swear on the pod? she has often said, fuck diversity and fuck inclusion. It's about belonging. And when we create spaces at work where people feel that they belong, that is when our work is done.
Brilliant. It's the belonging, finding a space to belong while you're living with chronic illness. That has been almost impossible and is only just moving.
Yeah, it profoundly changed the way that I think about all of this work, because it's not enough to say, you know, to have the statistics and the numbers that say, oh, we support our, you know, our wellness and health and whatever programs. It's about, like, do I feel safe coming to work and showing up as myself and saying, I'm just having a really rough day. I need to cancel all my calls, or I need to have all of my meetings without video because I cannot bring myself to look presentable, or I just need to take a nap today. You know, that is when you feel that, when you feel that you can say those things, is when you feel belonging. I have to say, I feel really fortunate to be in a place where I can do that. Salesforce is a magical place from that perspective. The other thing that I wanted to touch on is that I think that there are geographical and cultural differences here. Even though we both live in democratic, English-speaking countries, you and I, the degree to which insurance and your ability to not go broke is tied to your employer in this country, in the US, means that, like, you're going to do whatever you have to do to keep the job, especially if you're a low-wage worker, especially if you're early in your career, especially if you have pre-existing conditions and can't afford to lose your job. You are going to do whatever it takes and work through illness and work yourself to the breaking point, because if you lose your job, you will not be able to afford insurance and you will go broke in this country. And so the ability to even start the conversation with your manager or start the conversation with HR depends on a lot of privilege.
Yep.
That of those 130 million people that you quoted, I would guess 70% don't have.
Yeah. And this is the open moment why talking about it now is so important if you have that capacity. And one of the things I'm curious about in the time we've got left, Vadi, is, okay, so you've moved from Foresters to Salesforce. What is it about that company, or what is it in that space? Tell me about that for you now and who you are in this culmination of your experience, including depression, Hashimoto's, migraine. Yeah.
Yeah. So listen, I love Forrester. I will love my 11 years there. It's an amazing company and the people are amazing. And I felt incredibly well supported there. But I now get to work in Salesforce's Office of Ethical and Humane Use of Technology, which is a dream job. These positions didn't exist 3 years ago. And my job is to lead ethics by design for our software and services. So I literally get to embed ethics in the design, in the development, in the deployment of our products and services. It's a dream job. The reality of Salesforce is that it's an incredibly strong culture, and it has these five values, the first of which is trust. And it really does do walk the talk. And it is a now 75,000 person company nearly. And the fact that it's been able to maintain that culture and maintain those values and really, really take a human-centric approach to work is incredible. So taking that from a sort of Salesforce cultural perspective and then bring that in and narrow that lens and narrow that focus to this Office of Ethical and Humane Use, which includes product accessibility and inclusive design, which includes ethics by design, which includes ethical and responsible development of AI, which includes policy, ethical policy making. like I'm in the nexus point of people who are bringing their authentic selves to work every day, honestly, unabashedly, vulnerably. And I am grateful. I have so much gratitude to be alongside those people, because I've been very vulnerable and transparent with everybody. We have this thing that is a team agreement, a team operating manual. And everyone on the team has filled out, this is what it looks like when I show up with energy at work. This is what it looks like when I feel overwhelmed. This is what it looks like when, and this is how you can help when I feel overwhelmed. This is how I want to get feedback, and this is how I like to give feedback. I mean, everybody on the team is willing to share that information in a document. And so when we sit down to have hard conversations, we refer to that operating manual. And I know how I need to deliver feedback. I know how to show up for somebody if they're having a rough day. It's incredible. Like, I want this for the whole world.
What's interesting about that is you're actually talking about the emotional labor of going to the office, the unseen, hidden emotional labor that often women have carried. And when you live with chronic illness, that labor goes to a couple of trusted colleagues, and it comes to the very point I was making, is that labor can be dispersed, and it doesn't have to be labor. It's about connection. And I love this conversation about belonging, because if you have Crohn's disease and you're working in a corporation, and you have an incident, a process on the way to work that you have to change for or whatever, that is a very hidden thing that nobody wants to talk about. I don't have Crohn's disease, but what I know from all of the work that I've done are the women who have said to me, oh, thank God you are talking about this, because I can go to work with a sense of pride. I can go to work and stop feeling ashamed, because I know I am an extraordinary woman and I'm a very creative woman. Because if you are a woman living with chronic illness, you are an extraordinary woman and you are a very creative woman. You've had to be creative about how to get from bed to the shower on any given day. And this is not about inspiration. This is not about, you know, the courage of what it takes. You didn't ask for it. It is your lived experience, and you have had to work it out. And there is no great way to work this out. And that's what I'd really like to close with, Vati, is, you know, where do you see us at the moment? Because there's a lot of work to be done, and in no way, I feel, are you saying, I've worked this out.
Yeah. Listen, my goal and objective for the next decade of my career is to open doors behind me for other young women who are suffering, who are in this situation. Because as we're talking here, you and I suspect that we've had both experienced either an amazing mentor or an amazing opportunity to open a door for us. And I think of the thousands of women, as you were talking about Crohn's, I have a very good friend who just never tried, who just said, I'm never going to be able to go and sit in a client meeting or do a 1-hour presentation with confidence that I'm going to be okay. And I can't afford to take that risk. And so I'm just going to stay here in my middle management position that feels safe to me. I never want anyone, woman or a man, I never want anyone with chronic illness to feel that they can't do that because there's not somebody there supporting them. And so the next decade of my life is committed to mostly women in tech, mostly neurodivergent women in tech, women with chronic illness in tech, helping open doors, because I've got the privilege to do it. And that's what I hope my legacy can be.
And it's interesting because that's my decade. That's my decade too. I'm here for us to firstly transform the public conversation about it. But that's just just the smallest piece of the work. The work is actually helping women navigate career, helping them navigate our relationships, you know, a whole area that you and I haven't touched on. I feel like, oh, there's another whole podcast conversation here, Fadi, with you talking about that. But this conversation is not visible. And even you and I having this conversation, this is the first time we've had it at this level. And this conversation is not done between us. And it's not done between all the women that we know personally who are in the room with us. So I really want to thank you for being here in this moment, Fadi, because we're in a moment. And every woman listening to this, I want you to know that we're here, we're working with you, we're present with you. There are ways to follow us. There are ways to connect with us. There is nobody excluded from this conversation, no matter what your experience is. If you are bedbound and career is not even, like, it's just over from your perspective, I want to say to you, firstly, I work with women who are bedbound and this conversation can be had, and your dreams are still in your heart for a reason, and it may look very different. It may not be going to the office at all, but that doesn't mean that your creativity and your talent doesn't have a place in this world. And the other women that I'm speaking with in this process, you know, there's Danica Kim, who's an amazing artist, lives with endometriosis. There's a place for everybody in this room, and there's community and connection. So we'll have all of Fadi's connections in the show notes. You'll be able to follow her on Twitter and see the conversation that she's having, but also know that we're working towards creating more public space and corporate conversation together to have this very open and also how to navigate it, because it hasn't been done. And so nobody's going to get it right at this point in time. This is like pioneering work at this point in time. And it's so amazing that you and I, Fadi, this is our next decade individually. And I also feel we're in the hood together. This is our next decade together, because every woman listening to us and in this conversation, this is all of our next decade together. You don't have to be the advocate. We're going to carry that with you, but we're all in the hood together.
I absolutely love that.
Well, thank you so much for sharing with us, Fadi, so openly. I know this is the first time that you've publicly spoken about all of this journey and the vulnerability of that journey. And it's a big thing to come out and talk about it. And I super appreciate it.
Well, thanks for inviting me. I'm really excited to catch up and start having this conversation more publicly.
Thanks so much for joining us. If you want to explore connecting and working with me, Michelle, you can chat to me at michelleirving.com.au/chat, and we can book on a time to connect. And stay tuned for next week's episode, where we have another gorgeous, magnificent woman sharing with us about how to navigate chronic illness in an empowered way.